Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 21st, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, how the youngest generation will contribute with Neil Howe. He's the author with William Strauss of Generations, The Fourth Turning and Millennial Rising. Certainly, he is the most important and eloquent speaker today on the role of generations in social change. Our theme tonight is passing the baton. We're in a period of remarkable change. You know that every day as you watch what unfolds, whether it's in your own life or in the news. And we're watching new technology and its impact on how we live, work, and play. We're watching an understanding that our current relationship with our environmental ecosystem and our management of our finances has got to change. We're rebalancing the global economy as growth of people and economies in the developed world slows while the emerging markets rise. And across all of this, we have new younger generations moving into leadership throughout our society, and building alignments between generations to address this change is exceptionally important. And that starts with you and me. It starts in our families and our businesses, our workplace, and our communities. We're passing the baton, so let's do it well. And I hope that Neil Howe, our discussion tonight, his wonderful books and writings will help inspire you to do that in your own lives. First, a few things on events. We've been publishing cartoons. We started with one in the Fiscal Cliff article and then published one on Friday. Last Friday, we'll be putting them up on the Fridays once a month. And then also some quick, insightful videos called Solari Stories. They're going to be up on the blog every Wednesday. And then we've also posted them at our YouTube channel for the Solari Report with all the Just a Taste we do, which is just a little 2 to 4 minute from each Solari Report that we put up in video form up on the blog. Again, upcoming luncheons, we have Portland, Oregon on April 27th, and then Warsaw, Poland on June 22nd, Financial Salons, two of them in the San Francisco Bay Area in May. Money and markets. The top story this week, no doubt about it, is the swan dive in precious metal prices, along with nervousness as what could happen to the financial markets with a possible sequestration or other planned cuts in the federal budget in March. Earning reports have triggered lowered expectations over the last 2 weeks, including an earnings report from Walmart that is a sure sign of the struggle that you see many Americans dealing with. You can certainly see it here in Tennessee. You drive by a Walmart parking lot, you've never seen them so empty. It's not just at the lower end, though. We have Whole Foods lowering earning expectations as well. First, some comments on precious metals. Gold's currently trading at $1,580, silver's at $2,879. The drop this week was disappointing for many precious metals investors as we've seen a 17-month consolidation, and signals look like we were ready to move out of that consolidation period. Instead, prices have been moving lower. If you look at how long we've been in this consolidation or where the prices are today, we're still very much within acceptable ranges for a natural consolidation. If things don't turn up by mid-year or we drop below 1520, then we're going to need to revisit the primary trends. Franklin and I talked about it in the Precious Metals Market Report last week, and that transcript is now up on the blog. But as we discussed there, and I'll say it again today, there's no indication that the primary trend is over. That said, the re-engineering of the federal budget could have a very negative impact across the board on both corporate and household earnings and on all financial and commodities markets, whether through cuts or failure of the political process and various constituencies to manage that change maturely. So that means there is some risk, as I discussed in the wrap-up in January, that we could get a repeat of a 2008 scenario, which would mean lower prices across all the risk assets. There's an old saying that he who panics first panics best. However, there's no reason to consider hitting the panic button, or certainly not yet. And many of the charts on gold, silver, and mining stocks are beginning to look quite attractive. So let's see what unfolds over the next week. Many questions, should we sell gold? I would say no, except as we discussed last week in the Precious Metals Market Report. If you need to be rebalancing your portfolio and have large gains, And it depends on each person's unique situation, but it may be time to take some off the table if you want to make sure you have cash in the worst case scenario. So if you still have meaningful gold positions, then you'll take advantage if a rebound happens. Now, as governments struggle with budgets, the issue of tax policy and enforcement move to a top priority, not surprisingly. On the blog this week, China announces they're instituting a carbon tax. The specifics of what that really means yet to be understood. Ways and Means, interestingly enough, have announced 11 working groups to develop and publish proposals on April 15th, same as the individual tax date, in literally across the all the different areas for tax reform. When you open up the process to that wide a reconsideration, that's a meaningful event in Congress in Washington. The Economist publishes a big special on offshore havens and talks about why we should anticipate another round of the U.S. pushing banks around the world to comply with and be subject to the jurisdictions of U.S. laws, and how much money has leaked out in a variety of ways, both by institutions, corporations, and individuals as a result of this kind of leakage through the system. Don't be surprised if more U.S. depositors and investors are forced back into the U.S. as a result of the reaction of foreign corporations and financial institutions not wanting to pay the compliance costs or headaches. We also see a story about the continuing difficulties both in Europe and here of the application of the new Basel III bank regulations. Once these go into full effect, they will have a big impact on the U.S. financial system. But as we see in the story in the blog, banks in Europe still not able to agree on how to apply many aspects of the Basel III arrangements. But financialization marches on. We see the G20 meeting in Moscow last weekend, everybody promising no currency wars. But immediately, if you saw what happened to markets on Monday, you know that there's a little bit of a difference between what's happening in the markets and what's happening in the pronouncements. At the same time, Moscow Stock Exchange goes public for $500 million. So we are also seeing large corporations globally shifting a portion of large cash holdings that are earning very little into acquisitions. Berkshire Hathaway announcing a takeover of H.J. Heinz. Comcast buying the remaining 40% of NBC from GE. A merger of American Airlines and U.S. Air, big story will be up on the blog tomorrow. What we're watching is almost the completion of the consolidation of U.S. air traffic into four big carriers. It's a very different profile as it consolidates. And finally, in money and markets, don't you just love the Swiss? Novartis, one of Switzerland's largest pharmaceutical companies, was planning on paying its chairman who was departing, a $78 million non-compete payment, and got so much pressure from shareholders and lawmakers that they canceled the payment. First, the chairman offered to make the $78 million payment payable over 6 years to donate the entire amount to charity. That was still not acceptable, and the pressure was enormous. A reflection in part of the fact that Novartis has many Swiss shareholders. And if you study the democratic process in the Swiss canton system, the Swiss are remarkably committed to having an impact on policy, whether at the corporate or governmental level. But with unemployment rates among the young in Spain and Portugal now said to be 50%, it's hard to imagine that this kind of corporate largesse can be tolerated, and certainly not in Switzerland. So bravo for the Swiss. Our hero of the week is a nod to entrepreneurial activism. You can see this story up in the blog. It's rolled off of the homepage, but if you go down, you can find it. Jin Zhengmin, who is the CEO of an eyeglass retailer in China, decided to do something about pollution in waterways. If you look at the picture on the blog, you can see it's quite serious. And an effort to help clean up pollution in the waterways started posting photos on a microblogging service, somewhat like Twitter, the Chinese version of Twitter, to illustrate how rivers and other bodies of water in the country are polluted. And then in one photo, which featured a trash-clogged river in a rural town, offered a $32,000 cash reward to the local Environmental Protection Bureau chief if he would agree to swim in the polluted river. According to the South China Post, Morning Post, the local bureau chief has declined to accept the cash reward and to swim in the river, explaining that his department is not responsible for the pollution, but did say that he had alerted the Water Conservancy Bureau of the contamination, bureau about the contamination shown in the pictures. So entrepreneurial activism at its best, using transparency to inspire action by the bureaucracy. Very clever. Okay, a couple questions in Ask Catherine. One is, my name is Daniel, and then a question about what it's like as a young person to become a starter investor. And we'll respond to that question on March 21st. We're going to have a Solari report on how to do a Solari Circle Investment Club. But one of the focuses is going to be how families can come together and use an investment club within the family to start to teach how to go about investing between different generations. We did a Solari report on Solari Circles, both for liquid investment and securities and also non-liquid investment, and we'll pull out those documents and go back into both. Doing the securities is the easy way to go, but with crowdfunding getting going sometime this year with the SEC promulgating regulations, I think they'll also be interested in the non-security side, in looking at the private equity side through crowdfunding. Then a question from Bruce on digital currency. We've gotten a lot of questions on Bitcoin and other sort of digital payment systems. And so on March 7th, Eric Hughes is going to be joining us to talk about digital payments, including Bitcoins. And then, of course, we have more questions for Neil this evening. Now, I told Neil to come back at 8:20, but let me see if he's listening, because we could start early if he is available. Neil, any chance you're listening?
Hello.
Good. Hello. Okay, so let me introduce you, and then we can get started. I told you 8:20, but it turned out we could go much quicker. I am really delighted that Neil Howe could join us this evening. He's a historian, he's an economist, a demographer. He's best known for his work with William Strauss on social generations and generational cycles in American history and the implications to our future. He's authored and co-authored numerous bestsellers, including with Strauss, Generations, Fourth Turning, and Millennials Rising. I've read all of them. I recommend them to you highly. He runs LifeCourse Associates, which is a consulting firm in the Washington area that applies generational theories and Cyclum Research, that helps institutional investors understand long-term trends and how the future may be different from the past. He's a very, if you read Neil's books, his numerous studies, the work that you can find on his website, he's very, very unique in his reach. He can reach back through time and forward in the future. He can look at things from point of views of government, of companies, of institutional investors, of individual households. He can look at things from numerous cultures globally. So he can work at the highest policy level or at the most intimate level in terms of understanding the ongoing creation that happens between culture and economy. And it's a rare person who can really comprehend the full range of our human and financial ecosystems and think about them dynamically. And so that's an invaluable person to have in the invention room as we address the challenges before us. So I can't be happier that he can join us on the Solari Report. So, Neil, thank you for starting early.
Well, Catherine, that was an impressive introduction. I'll have something to live up to here.
Well, we have a wonderful production team at the Solari Report, as I've told you, and they're all millennials, which is your term for the upcoming generation. And I can't tell you how excited that they are that you're going to be on tonight. And I think they're thinking, oh, at last, somebody who can help explain to these older generations who we are and how to work with us. So we're very excited. So
someone to explain just how special they are, right?
Well,
so
I think
millennials are special. That's the first thing I tell people. They were special since the day they were born.
Well, I think they are special. So I have a point of view on that. Well, tell us about generational theory, how you came to develop it, and then introduce us to the generations that we are and that we're working with.
Well, it's a long story. I was working down as a policy analyst. You know, I worked with Pete Peterson for many years, writing books on entitlement policy and fiscal policy. And I came down to Washington. I met Bill Strauss, who had another career, actually. He founded the Capital Steps. So they used to introduce us on stage, and they would say to Bill, he's, you know, they point to me, they say, I'm historical, and to Bill, they say, he's hysterical. So that's how we would get introduced. But seriously, the two of us worked on many books together, and the first one was Generations. It came out in 1991, a very long book to do. It took us 3 years full-time, both of us working on it, because we had to reconstruct history from a completely different perspective as groups of people, generations aging over time. So, you know, historians never do that. They talk about everyone does this in this year, 1851, and 1852, they say what everyone is doing in that year. They never follow the same group, right? They never follow the same group and find out what collective experiences shaped its attitudes, shaped its behavior, explain how it behaved between the time it was in its youth and the time it exercised midlife leadership or its the style of midlife parenting. This is a generational look at how history works, and we're all familiar with it in our own life. And we simply apply it to history and look at all the great secrets it unfolds. You know, why, for instance, the Civil War took place when the children of the time of the American Revolution, the John Quincy Adamses, were old people, and how they saw themselves as the one generation who was present at the founding of the Republic, and as great tragedy they feared they would witness the dissolution of the Republic that they recalled in their childhood, and why that impelled them to behave certain ways, and why the generation born just after the American Revolution had such a wild trajectory. You know, they were the transcendentals. They were religious prophets and poets and radicals. They founded communes all over the Northeast. They gave us the Second Great Awakening, and then later on, as elder leaders with Lincoln and Jefferson Davis, they took us right into our next great national catastrophe. Here's what I think of in my kind of nightmarish moments, and that is, what's the generation today that was born just after the last great catastrophe that doesn't remember it? What's the generation that has no memory of World War II? It's boomers, right?
Right.
They
came
of
age
during
the prophets
revolution. And by the way, some historians call them the 60s and 70s America's fourth or fifth great awakening, depending on whether you want to start with, you know, John Winthrop or Jonathan Edwards. But they have been moralists all their life, and today they are leaders, elder leaders of America's culture wars, red zone, blue zone, and they've brought government in this country to its knees. Nothing is happening anymore in Washington. I live here, and it's all just ground to a halt. We haven't had a budget in 4 or 5 years, and then at monetary policy, that's broken. It's just stuck on hold. We've got the accelerator all the way to the floor, and seemingly nothing matters anymore. So we have government now stewarded by elder boomers, and absolutely nothing works up here. And these are the patterns that I look at. I look at these, why is it that all of the great crises of American history, World War II and the Great Depression, the Civil War, the American Revolution, occurred just when those born right after the last crisis were elder leaders, that is to say, stewarded the country with no one older than them around. And I think there are lessons. There are many other lessons about generational aging in history, but that's one of them. And this led us to look at American history back in our first book. not just as a sequence of different generations with very different collective personalities, but what we found is these personalities had a certain rhythm or pattern in how they appeared. These personalities weren't just appear randomly. Certain kinds of generations tend to follow other kinds of generations. And that led us toward the end of the book, implicitly, to a certain pattern of American history, four different types, basic archetypes of generations giving rise to four different kinds of moods recurring rhythmically throughout American history. And as you know, Catherine, we explored that later in a book that we did in 1997 called The Fourth Turning. And in The Fourth Turning, we predicted, you read the book, you remember, we predicted that sometime in the middle of the 00 decade, America would enter a new season of crisis. And we called it a fourth turning. We said we've had these times before in American history. We will have them again. And I will say one other thing. I'm not totally negative about fourth turnings. You know, everyone says, oh, crisis, that's horrible, you know. But, you know, fourth turnings can be great in some ways. We tear down old institutions and we build new ones again.
We have the winter so that we can have a spring.
Excuse me?
We have the winter. You call it the winter.
These are the winters of history, but it's in the winter of history that we tear down everything that doesn't work and we build things that work. I mean, think about the Great Depression and World War II. They were horrible in some ways. But think about the generation that came of age during that period, the GI generation, you know, the greatest generation. Yeah. And by the time that they were turning 40 and 50, they had created an America of interstates and suburbs, of nearly universal home ownership, union membership, a great equality of living standards, and an affluence that no one dreamed of. We were a world power. We were transformed through that fourth turning. And so fourth turnings are transformative. They are also very dangerous. They're very dangerous times. But through these times, we go through public trauma and public rebuilding that are very unlike the other seasons of our history.
Now, I just have to interrupt and quote read a quote from The Fourth Turning, because I do want to inspire people to read this. You're talking about, you write a chapter called The Fourth Turning Prophecy, and you say, based on recent unraveling era trends. Now, remember, you're writing this in 1997. Ladies and gentlemen, Neil is writing this in 1997. Publishing this in 1997. Based on recent unraveling era trends, the following circa 2005 scenarios might seem plausible. And one of them is, an impasse over the federal budget reaches a stalemate. The president and Congress both refuse to back down, triggering a near-total government shutdown. The president declares emergency powers. Congress rescinds his authority. Dollar and bond prices plummet. The president threatens to stop Social Security checks. Congress refuses to raise the debt ceiling. Default looms. Wall Street panics. Quite extraordinary.
That was pretty lucky. We certainly no one was thinking about that in 1987. We also, I think, we had four little examples of triggers. That was one of them. I think another one was a terrorist attack. Do you remember that?
Yes, I remember that too.
I think it was
the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced the spread. Oh no, a global terrorist group blows up an aircraft. Yeah, it announces it possesses portable nuclear weapons. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, but what we were trying to do, of course, is it wasn't the details of the crisis. Here's what people sometimes say. They say, Neil, I don't understand this at all. I mean, come on, Pearl Harbor, it just happened. The Japanese attacked us, right? I mean, how does the cycle explain that?
Right.
But here's how we think of history. History. Accidents happen all the time. There are always events that happen, right? But
right.
Some events flare briefly and then they die out. Other events are like triggers, they're catalysts of a society waiting to change its mood, and it changes it permanently. So, for example, there was the sinking of the Lusitania, and there was the Zimmerman telegram. These were, you know, huge provocations in 1916, 1917, but we didn't want to go into World War One. We went very late. It was a highly controversial war, and as soon as the war was over, America hated it. You know, by 1920, there was not a single soldier posted in any other country in the world. That's how much we turned isolationist after that war. So we hated that war, and it didn't do anything to change us. But right. Look at World War II. We voted right. almost unanimously to go to total war the next day. And we were totally a different place when that war was over. And I would argue that was because our generational constellation had shifted. We were a country ready to do different things. And we try to explain why that is in our work.
One of the things I remember about my father's generation coming back from World War II, he knew people from every place and every walk of life. And there was a classlessness about how he approached the world because he'd been at war and fought with men and women from every different walk of life and came back with a respect for all of them. So there was a kind of spirit and bond and commitment to meritocracy that you don't see now. That was very extraordinary. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And we, if you look, for instance, at most measures of inequality over the 20th century, it reached a peak in the late 1920s. It came down in the 30s, came down in the 40s, and, you know, then finally reached its low point in the late 1960s, just when that GI generation was retiring, right? Kind of at its peak right. of its prosperity, beginning to, you know, move to Sun City and leisure world. And ever since, it's been rising again. And now right. it's back where it was back in the late 1920s. And you don't think that that doesn't have a generational component? I mean, the GI generation stood for one-size-fits-all benefits. They stood uh-huh. for radical equalization of wages through the union movement, which was yeah. the apogee of power in the 1950s. Union participation today is back where it was in 1909 or something like that, the 19-teens. So, you know, and why? Because the generation that grew up, many of them, of course, were the children of the greatest generation, which were the boomers, were a very different generation. The GIs stood for community, community above all, community during war. They were the most uniformed generation per capita in American history. Community in the suburbs when they returned home. Every little box looked the same. And then community right. when they moved into leisure world. You know, they still all looked the same, and they all, you know, they all listened to Benny Goodman music, and, you know, it was very kind of corny music. The boomers were very different.
Yeah, the boomers
were a generation. Yeah?
It was boomers and some silent generation. I found, you know, in the financial system, the leadership has been very, very committed to centralization of capital and sort of economic management of resources. Part of that is they're competing globally, you know, and they're globalizing. But part of it is they don't have that same commitment to, you know, to equality that was present 20 years before.
But, you know, we deliberately rebelled against the regimentation of our GI parents. They gave us this middle class of similarity, of blandness, of conformity. We hated it. We wanted right. everyone to be different. And right. the awakening that we triggered, Catherine, I mean, it was on our watch. We were the ones coming of age during that period. We're catalysts for, and there have been many awakenings in American history, and they've all issued in the same thing. They've all ultimately issued in a much more individualistic society. This has been the product of every awakening of American history. And when did the awakening of the 60s and 70s end? The Reagan 1980s. Free agency, right. deregulation, tax cuts, everyone does anything they want. And the awakening that began over cultural issues about what you could dress and what words you could say, you know, the kind of the Archie Bunker and All in the Family kinds of issues, ended in economic liberation. So it started in cultural liberation, ended in economic liberation. And as a result, the boomers have been a generation, particularly first wave to last, of increasing income and asset inequality. And we see that very strong. And, I, you know, I'm an economist, and I study this stuff, and I look at it. And Boomers revel in their individuality. I mean, I go to the airport and I see those red carpet lanes, depending on what kind of card you have and how much money you have. Our parents, the GIs, would have recoiled at that.
Right. Well, and I think it's fair to say that the cultural belief that anything goes, combined with the federal budget, has been a very bad cocktail. Anyway,
yeah,
it is.
And of course, yeah, it's like we can have our MAPO and we can have everything we want, and there are no rules. I do think that boomers have, look, boomers are cultural titans, and I will say one thing about boomers. Boomers belong to a very different kind of archetype. Let me back up, Catherine, and just say something very, very basic, which I think everyone has to understand and listen to me, and that is there's no such thing as a good generation or a bad generation. I firmly believe this. Every generation has its purpose, and in a sense, we need every generation to be the way it was at the time, right? It's shaped inevitably in certain ways by the circumstances in which it was raised, what we call its location in history. Boomers are raised at a time when they were practically begged them to become individualists and free thinkers. Even their own parents built all these colleges so they could go out and ask why, and tell their parents why they built all the things they built, you know?
Yeah.
And so boomers became that kind of generation, and as a result, I often like to say that the fourth turnings of history, the great outer world crises, right, is when society focuses on transforming the outer world. And the generations that come of age at that time, we call the hero archetype, like the GI generation, or like the Republican generation back in the 1780s and 90s, you know, the generation of Hamilton and Madison and Monroe and all those, you know, rationalists. But there's another kind of generation, and that's what we call the prophet archetype, and they're the ones who come of age during the awakening. And these kinds of generations don't focus on rebuilding the outer world. They focus on rebuilding the inner world of culture, values, art, religion, spirituality. They renew the culture. They renew values. And I do believe that's a great boomer strength. I mean, you look at music, you look at movies, you look practically anywhere in our culture. It was reshaped in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and boomers still preside over the culture. Who do we bring on to that halftime in the Super Bowl? Tom Petty, Mick Jagger, these guys are pushing, I don't know, their mid-60s, or, you know. I mean, come on, I mean, we bring on all these elderly people today. I mean, the rock concerts are just, you know, aging. I mean, everyone can see that. And millennials are fine with that. Millennials go to summer camps to learn to do Led Zeppelin riffs and stuff, and they play Guitar Hero and Rock Band, and they love that. They love all that old stuff. Pop culture to millennials does not have the same relationship to them that pop culture had to boomers. For us, it was a religion, it was a serious cultural statement, and it also reflected a fundamental alienation from the values of our parents, which made us, you know, which made it so important to us. There's none of that with millennials today. And when I travel, Catherine, I often go and ask people, what's the iPod overlap in your family? So I ask them, how many songs, so if you're in your 50s, how many songs on your iPod are also on your teen or 20-something's iPod? And vice versa. You know, and when I first started asking that about 10 years ago, people were saying, oh, 20, 30% same songs. Now people are saying 50, 60%.
Really?
One boomer I asked, oh, they're all the same songs. We just kind of share them, you know.
Really?
Midlife parents and their kids today, they wear the same brand name clothing. They email each other about the same movies. They talk to each other about intimate aspects of their life. We did not have iPods back in 1969 or 1973, but if we had had them, would not have been a single song the same as our parents, right? I think you can attest to that.
Right. Well, my dad loved Nat King Cole and Dinah Washington and all those folks, and I did too. So there would have been a little bit, but You're right. He would not have had Jimi Hendrix on his iPod, that's for sure.
I don't think of it. Maybe Jim Morrison would have been there either, right? Yeah.
Right. No. Right. Tell us about the millennials, because when I read Millennial Rising, I hadn't realized how much bigger the millennial generation is than the boomers. You know, the boomers are used to thinking of themselves as the biggest generation, but that's not the case. We have a generation coming on now and coming of age now and coming into leadership who's bigger than us.
The quantitative issue is, yes, they are bigger in absolute numbers. They are, however, the result of a much lower fertility rate, right? We have a much larger society, so that they're not as big relative to the number of older people. See, you see what I mean?
Ah, okay. True.
They are, however, the product of a baby boomlet that began to occur in the late 70s, early 80s, and it just kept on going. The fertility rate rose through the 80s and 90s, and they followed, of course, Generation X. We define Xers as people born mostly in the 1960s and 70s. And remember, you know, I talked earlier about that period of awakening when boomers are coming of age, and we had social experimentation and family experimentation and all these crusades and so forth. Boomers were coming of age into adulthood, but what generation were actually the kids who were being born and raised as little kids? Well, those would have been Xers, right?
Uh-huh.
So Xers were the children of that era. And, of course, because everyone was busy finding themselves, they were the throwaway children of that era, a time when children were, schools were falling apart, families were breaking apart, people didn't want to have children. The fertility rate fell in the 60s and 70s. The lowest fertility rate in American history was 1976, you know, just a couple of years after Watergate. So they were a small generation. People didn't want to have them, and the entire culture turned anti-child. You remember all those childhood devil horror movies, you know, Damien and Exorcist
right.
and It's Alive. And it was a horrible celebration, a horrible image of childhood. And it was an era when children were, you know, given latchkey guides and self-care guides. I can go into a high school classroom today or a college classroom, and I could talk about latchkey kids. And today's millennial kids absolutely not understand what I'm talking about. What's a latchkey kid? Every Xer I've talked to knows what a latchkey kid is. It means you are on your own. You can't trust anyone. Here's a guide. Survive. And, of course, with Xers, that has led to amazing resilience and survival skills. They've even... in their 40s, they still watch Survivor shows, and, you know, that whole sensibility ages with them. But millennials are different. Millennials came along. We think a good first birth year for the millennials was 1982. Suddenly, the boomers are settling down. All that family experimentation stopped. Everyone was into family values. There were these new minivans. Do you remember them? The family-oriented cars that were suddenly popular. With bumper stickers on the back, baby on board, you know, none of that ever was for the Xers. All these special seat belts to protect these precious cargo. And all kinds of things started changing. The whole child protection industry started that time. Fathers present at the birth of their kids, the Lamaze movement. A complete change in how children were seen cinematically and in the pop culture, right? All those cuddly baby movies like Baby Boom and Parenthood and remember John Travolta and all those movies. So everything began to shift. And millennials grew up as the special children of parents who chose to have them. They didn't have them because they were accidents. They didn't have them because they were mistakes. And it created a very different generation growing up, of course, at a very different time. The other thing was, of course, the economy and society was a gradual period of prosperity. When was the stock market at its all-time low, the Dow, in real terms? The first birth year of the millennials, right? Wasn't it 1982? Volcker was still handling
it.
I think it was 82 or 83. It was just, you know.
Well, I remember the prime rate hitting above 17 or 18%.
Yeah, that was about a year earlier. But, you know.
It was 80.
Volcker took over, put his foot on the brakes, and anyway, it was. Everything began to get better, and we had a few setbacks, but, you know, it was this slow rise. It was the great boom, one of the great financial booms of American history, coincided with this new millennial generation.
Right.
And by the late 1990s, by the way, we call them millennial because the first of them graduated high school. They were the high school class of 2000, right? So it's, you know, nice,
right.
nice timing there. But right around that time, we began to notice some huge changes in youth. And we've continued to notice those changes in, you know, since 2000 to today. One of them is kind of the most remarkable, and I could say you say one of the most positive changes in youth, particularly considering the trends that the boomers and Xers put into place, was this cross-the-board turning away of youth from personal risk-taking. And we saw this most dramatically in the crime rate. You know, it's amazing how little credit kids get today. The victimization rate and perpetrator rate for serious violent crime of, you know, late teens, early 20s, has fallen by about 75%.
It's very dramatic.
Early mid-1990s, when it peaked with Xers. This is probably the most dramatic decline in youth crime in American history. And you know, Catherine, we did predict that. I mean, remember in Generations, we talked about what kind of generation this would be. Teen drinking is down. Teen cigarette smoking is way down. In fact, low cigarette smokers are now, with millennials, up into their late 20s, early 30s, which is one reason why preterm births are now going down after rising for 30 years. This is all good news. This is a generation that gets into traffic accidents much less.
Right.
In fact, one of the problems with millennials for auto manufacturers is they don't like cars very much. The miles driven by under 30 for the last decade has been going down, while it's been going up for older people. Cars owned per capita is going down. What are the
right? It's bad news for TV. TV watching is going down.
TV watching. Yeah, of course. One of the reasons they don't have to drive is because they can see each other electronically. They don't have to go there in person. But there's one other thing. What is it has sold the brand of cars to boomers and Xers and even the silent generation with T-Birds when they were young? Risk and independence. Risk and independence. What are the two things that just don't seem to resonate much with millennials? Risk and independence. Take independence. The share of 25 to 35-year-olds living with their parents has doubled since 1980. It was going up before the Great Recession, and now it's continued to go up, of course, accelerating because of unemployment and so forth. Boomers and millennials are living together. You know, those age groups at a rate that we haven't seen since the late 1940s. And they actually get along pretty well in most cases. We've looked at a lot of opinion surveys. Pew and others have done a tremendous amount of work on this. But it reshapes so many things. For instance, why you have to co-market to young people today with their family, with their parents. I mean, we talked to financial services about this. Forget the nuclear family. You have to go over the multi-generational family, and don't forget the grandparents. Don't forget the silent generation, which today often has all the money. I mean, they're setting up the college plans for the kids. They're funding the family vacations. We've never seen 70-plus so affluent relative to the 40-minus or the 30-minus.
Right. Now, this generation you describe, the millennial generation you describe as being very you know, I would say supportive of major institutions. And yet, if you look at what's happened in the last 10 years, sort of financially, and the load of student debt they've taken on, and the what's happened in the economy, they're really struggling with a major economic challenge as a group. And you also describe them as preferring long-term employment, you know, as opposed to entrepreneurship. And yet, if you look at trends in automation, what's happening in the economy, entrepreneurship is the thing that is, to me, it looks like it's most needed.
Well, I mean, here's the difference. You know, boomers were the first ones to really sort of champion entrepreneurship, you know, breaking away, you know, saying just shove it to your employer and all that. And the economy was generally pretty good for them. Xers really embraced it as a whole lifestyle. I mean, Xers, I think, will go down as one of the great generations of entrepreneurs in American history. They're used to going it alone. They're used to just living off incentive pay and taking risks. This is a generation impelled to take risks, and they're good at it. And I think what's very interesting about millennials is that you do see a lot of millennials setting up their own portfolio and doing their own businesses. But here's the big difference. Millennials are doing it in order to get in the door and get a permanent job. Right. In other words, their goal is security and permanence. And they're doing entrepreneurship because they can't go directly there. It's their way of working into it, whereas you know, boomers in their day wanted to work out of it. So I think that if you look at aspirations for millennials, they're not at all the same as the lifestyle they're living now. They want an in loco parentis employer. They love fringe benefits. We know that from all the surveys we've seen. They love tax prep assistance and relocation assistance. They love all that stuff. They want lots of feedback. They want mentors. They want people around them, helping them, guiding them. They trust big institutions. One thing I think all Americans know by now is that they trust big government. I mean, that's why they vote so heavily for Obama in 2008 and 2012. They think communities, institutions working together can help each other, and they would love older people to help them.
One of the reasons I like the millennials so much is I find them in the workplace to be very good at collaboration, very good at teamwork. They're very into optimizing. You know, they not only look at things from their own point of view, but sort of what are the points of view of the other people on the team, and how do we optimize together? And I think part of it is they've grown up with information technology, and they're much more used to sort of networking and operating in networked forms. But and I think you describe this in Millennial Rising. They're very focused on how. Let's get something done here, whereas the boomers are, you know, will stand and squabble about values or philosophic points, whereas the millennials are much more...
Want to make a point. Now, boomers want to make a point. They want their viewpoint to be heard. Millennials are more about getting things done. I often say that to a boomer, the most important thing is who you are, which is to a millennial, that's what you do, you know.
Right.
And I think these are fundamental differences. In part, millennials are set in motion to this to sort of correct for the excesses of their own boomer parents. If you look at the way, for instance, they like to hear the news, they like it to be funny. They like it to be light. You know, it's kind of Comedy Central. It's these very sort of mild shows late night. They love that. You know, the slow jazz on the news. What they hate are the angry talking heads. So, you know, whether it's on the left or right, MSNBC or Fox News, absolutely, you should have to see the ratings of those shows for, you know, under 30. I mean, literally, no one under 30 watches those shows. One thing I have noticed when I see millennials getting together to work on a political platform or to discuss an idea is that the one thing they hate most among their peers is getting mad at each other. It's like, you know, that's how you behave like your boomer parent, you know. And so there's a huge premium. Let me give you one kind of trivial example, because I often go onto college campuses and I meet boomer professors. They say, there's one thing about this generation. I always love to have debate, you know, kind of Socratic debate. I love to have two people take two different sides and rip into each other. And they can't get the millennials to do that. So the millennials will come to them and say, we really have to debate. Can't we just agree on a consensus plan and tell you why? So
we need to basically replace all of our Congress people with millennials.
Well, we may be soon, because I think maybe America will just usher everyone currently out of there and just put a whole new group in. We have actually predicted that millennials will be a generation of unusual political strength, partly because late-wave boomers and Xers are such a void politically in terms of political engagement, interest in politics, the high quality caliber of people running for office. So we think that millennials, particularly given this huge trust deficit, that voters will gladly usher this new generation at a relatively young age into relatively high positions of political power.
One of the things that we talk a lot sort of internally in the team at Slayer Report is, and I think it weighs heavily on all of us, is all the divide and conquer politics we watch. And we're constantly talking about how can we build alignment, you know, between men and women or different generations or different race or religion. And the divide and conquer politics has gotten extraordinarily draining. Now, part of it is every time you go through a presidential campaign, it happens. But I see how much they just struggle with, ugh, why do we have to do all of this thing? And I think one of the reasons I was so glad to have you on the Solari Report is because I wanted to talk about in our own lives. You know, we can't help what's on Fox News, but in our own lives, whether it's in our families or in the workplace or in our communities or networks, how do we start to build those alignments between, and we haven't talked about the Homelanders, which is the next one behind the millennials, but how do we start to get the boomers and the millennials aligning in a way that can bring about the most healthy kinds of results in a fourth turning? What do we do? What do I do?
I think it's getting every generation to participate with their strengths. I still think that boomers are a generation with a lot to give in terms of inspiration, values, standards, principles, vision. This is one thing that millennials really rely on boomers for. That's why millennials are still spellbound by boomer art and music and so on. They still find it amazing. The problem is that we need to unclench the boomer fingers from the actual levers of power. Okay. Have them be visionaries. Just get your hands off the actual machinery, you know, back up slowly, you know. And I think Xers will be a brilliant generation for this era of crisis because they are so practical and pragmatic. They're used to taking risks. I think I very much trust Xers in power. We had a generation very similar to the Xers, later became known as the Lost Generation, born in the 1880s and 1890s, who were the midlife leaders of World War II. You know, the Eisenhowers, the Pattons, the Ridgeways, the Omar Bradleys. Uh-huh. The same kind of hard scrabble generation. They knew everything bad that could happen. And they were just the right generation to be hands-on leaders. And I think we need to invite millennials as they mature. You know, their eldest are now passing 30, to harness all of that team energy and all of that optimism and confidence despite, you know, everything that's been happening to them economically. And build a better world. Create a new sense of community. And I think that will happen, and that spirit will become evident, you know, late in this fourth turning season. And with any luck, our country is going to come out of this period, this generation long period, a much brighter, more hopeful place.
One of the big challenges, of course, you know, this all comes down to the federal budget because so much of the U.S. economy at this point runs through the appropriations or contracts or regulations that emanate out of Washington. You know, you and I talked this week about the extent of the unfunded liabilities in that on the federal balance sheet. And part of that is the generational, you know, is a generational challenge between entitlements that have been promised but are unfunded, and then, you know, younger generations coming up that are going to be called on to fund it, as opposed to, for example, investing in infrastructure, which many of us would love to see. So all of these tensions come down to generational tensions to me come down to the federal budget and the questions and answers that have to be addressed in Washington over the next couple of years. Do you
it's a terrible problem. I mean, right now, the tax money that comes in goes to pay for entitlements, you know, basically goes to individuals as checks, healthcare providers, and creditors. And, right. and there's nothing left over for anything that's appropriated, you know, practically. We borrow for everything else. And of course, it's being hacked and it's being squeezed because we can't seem to cut anything that, you know, we personally get. I mean, that's why we've become a society of entitled individuals. We can't actually cut anything that goes to any person, so we cut back on everything that we collectively build. You know, our parks and the weather service and civil service, and, you know, our defense is going to be cut horribly. If the sequester goes through and continues for the next several years, defense in about 4 years will be under 3% of GDP, which is lower than any year since Pearl Harbor. The size of the cutback and what this is going to do to the economy, I think, has not been fully realized. With all this ecstatic joy that we missed the fiscal cliff, people don't realize that, you know, given what was the acronym, ACTRA, with the tax hike that was passed, plus the payroll tax cut, plus the sequester, is going to be about 60% of the fiscal cliff in terms of fiscal drag on the economy. I think just that in the short term carries the strong risk of a recession. I mean, I'm not hopeful in the short term, and the long term, I think that there is so much truth that has to be faced that we haven't faced. The difference between what all Americans alive today expect to receive from government and what they expect to pay to government has a present value of about $100 trillion. And, you know, the Medicare and Social Security trustees calculate this every year. It is enormous, okay? There is disappointment that has to be handed out. This is completely the opposite of the 60s and 70s and 80s when government distributed pleasure. Now government has to distribute pain. And I don't think we're still not ready for it yet, although I do say that it's very encouraging to see surveys show that deficit reduction and finally really getting serious about the deficit and the debt, even just allowing the sequester to go forward, is surprisingly popular to the American public at the moment.
But it's, to me, there's a huge cultural change. I used to have, one day I was sitting in Washington when I had an investment bank there, and I looked at one of my partners who I realized had grown up on Montserrat, and I said, Ozzie, how come so many of my partners grew up on islands? And he said, because when you're on an island, you see the connection between your behavior and sort of what happens. And you understand that what goes around comes around. And you see that yourself as a player in the whole. And he said, America is so big that everybody just thinks, you know, I can go get mine and I don't need to care about making the pie bigger. And what I find with the millennials is they're much more sensitive about understanding the relationship between what they're doing and whether it's having a positive impact, you know, for the world as well as themselves. And if you sit in Congress, what you realize is we have a lobbying process and a political process where everybody's focused on getting there, and there's no concept of I'm also responsible to make the pie bigger. And that's a huge cultural shift to get an entire society to convert their cultural and economic model to that we're all responsible for the whole. And we each need to contribute, each in our own way.
It is. Yeah. And I think, just for example, thinking of connectedness, America is used to thinking of itself as the owners and holders of the world's reserve currency. So we don't have to worry about the value of our money, right? Everything will be value to us. So, if there's a world crisis, even if we cause the crisis, well, the value of the dollar will rise. I mean, it's just De Gaulle, Charles de Gaulle used to call this America's exorbitant privilege. But it is amazing. I mean, it conditions how we Americans look at the world. There are no rules for us, right?
Right. A couple questions from listeners. Let me just put them to you. You can see this one has not had the experience with the millennials I have. Neil, he's talking about the millennials. Are they entrained by their public education to want the boundaries, or can they still inspire themselves out of the box? I want to know if they are ignorant slaves or even more aware than my generation that what works well is worth doing until they have to create even better solutions.
Well, I don't know who's the generation of the person asking the question.
I suspect this is a boomer.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One thing I've noticed is that, and I do this a lot in the workplace, because, you know, people often ask me, that a lot of the big problems, generational tensions, are in the workplace.
Yeah.
You have these extra managers and supervisors who are used to just, you know, no one, basically their attitude is, when I came into the workplace, no one cared about it. I was just thrown and I had to just figure it out, right? It was a school of hard knocks. And the idea that millennials need structure and, you know, all this care and feeding is just, despite the fact that it makes their job easier if they do it, they just can't do it because they temperamentally, it's just not right. No one treated me like that, right? It's almost a sense of unfairness. And I think that very often I find, and with Xers, and particularly with boomers, because, of course, boomers have children who are the age of millennials in the work. And that is that they always think their own children are the exception. I get that every time I do presentations on this. They come up to me later and they say, you know, my kid has all these characteristics. You know, he's a team player. He's optimistic. He's sort of conventional. They go on and on about all these things. But I thought that generation was a complete mess and my child was a complete exception, you know, and I get that reaction a lot.
Okay, well, another question is, where are the career and entrepreneurial opportunities going to be for all of us over the next couple decades?
All of us, meaning young people?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I think almost by necessity, the biggest need is going to be, in fact, it's already opening up, in those institutions with the oldest workforces, right, who are top-heavy with boomers. Because now, despite the fact a lot of boomers can't afford to retire, and in fact, boomers now are just, you know, the retirement age is just steadily ratcheting up now. One little factoid, and that is that since the peak of employment in late 2006 or whenever that was, sort of peak, the economy's lost about 4 million jobs. But this is what's interesting. It's lost 7 million under age 60, gained 3 million over age 60. One of the most amazing facts is that employment over age 60 has been rising steadily throughout the Great Recession.
Yeah.
Boomers aren't retiring. It's as simple as that. And so they continue to work. However, obviously many of them have to retire and will be retiring. And those are the institutions which would be sucking millennials in. They just need to have people. I'm talking about manufacturing companies, extractive industry like energy and I'm also looking at government. This is one way in which we are going to have a precocious political generation because all of these government agencies, particularly at the federal level, have huge numbers of boomers. You know, the Xers never joined or were ripped out in the 90s. So all of these boomers are going to be retiring, and they have to hire millennials. And the GAO and many of the federal agencies have very aggressive policies now to get the best and brightest of this generation into government agencies. And, of course, millennials, that's one of their top picks as seniors in college now. One of their top picks as a favorite employer is FBI, CIA, Peace Corps, Teach for America, you know, all of these sort of public-oriented institutions.
Right. Well, tell me, Neil, if people listening really want to dive in and understand the millennials, I had recommended Millennials Rising and then the PBS special, Millennials, a Profile of the Next Great Generation. Are there other materials that you would recommend they read?
You know, one thing they can go to, particularly if people are, you know, busy in institutional investing, we do have one website of a service that we do offer to institutional investors, but there's a lot of information there that's biographical, and I think, you know, you can get, there's you know, periodicals and videos and a number of things, certainly a huge bibliography of everything we've done on Saeculum Research. Okay, that's saeculumresearch.com. That's S-A-E-C-U-L-U-M, research. Saeculum, by the way, is an interesting term that we use in the fourth turning to describe a natural lifespan, which is this kind of original Etruscan meaning, and the ultimate timer of some of these cycles that we see. And in there you can, you know, sample, I think, some of our views, not just on the economy, but also we do a lot of work in demography. And some readers might be interested in a book that I did with Richard Jackson at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where I help lead something called the Global Aging Initiative. We did a book called The Graying of the Great Powers.
That's excellent. I just finished reading it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you want one-stop shopping on the total impact of global aging, economically, culturally, socially, and particularly geopolitically, how it's going to change the world, that's a nice place to start.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Okay, well, last question, and one of the things we think about at the Soleri Report a lot is what can we do, you know, in our own way, with whether it's with subscribers or families that we're working with, to really help them, to help them prepare and work through the fourth turning. You know, what are the actions we can each take in our own lives to do that? And any other thoughts you have on that would be appreciated, because I feel like we're all inventing the pathway together through this, what's going to be an enormous change, and we're just at the beginning.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, to realize that it's a time of trial, but also of great hope. You know, this is the lesson of history, that, you know, that rhythms are things you experience, and you try to you don't try to deny things are going to happen, but you try to participate constructively in their outcome. Fourth turning is going to have good or bad outcomes depending on how well we manage ourselves, and part of managing our behavior is understanding what our strengths are and how we can be constructive. I think that for a lot of boomers and Xers thinking about their millennial kids, I think it's to understand that their attributes, this sense of collective specialness, this belief in teamwork, the sheltering that they've experienced, the surprising conventionality of their beliefs about risk taking and how loyal they are to family. Although obviously this is a generation that defines family a lot more broadly than older people. But all of these things will be the foundation for the America after this crisis. And I think that it's very important for older people not to fight them, but to see that if you really understand what this generation is about, that they represent the generation that is going to build a new America based on our values. You know, we boomers have created all these new values, but it's the next generation. You know, it's Barack Obama used to say this, right? The generation of Moses versus the generation of Joshua. You know, one generation thinks up the big ideas, it's another generation that actually implements it, right? Actually is led into the land of Canaan and actually builds a new society. And I think that's the kind of contrast we're talking about. Boomers are a great generation of vision and values, and their kids will be a great generation of builders who will in many ways reflect those visions, just in the same way that the GIs built a post-war world to reflect the visions of FDR and Stimson and all of the titanic figures who led them through that crisis.
The gentleman who asked the first question just sent in a message. He said, I'm 53, boom, boom. Now, if he's 53, is he a boomer or Gen X?
He's a late wave boomer, yeah.
Yeah, he's a late wave boomer, okay.
Could sometimes coin Generation Jones, you know, for people born in the late 50s, early 60s. It's sort of the tail end of the boom and the early part of the Xer, and it was an unusually difficult, dazed and confused time to go through, you know, elementary school and middle school.
Oh, I remember. Well, Neil, thank you so much for joining us tonight on the Soleri Report. I'm a great admirer of your work, and I appreciate it very much. And if for the first time, I feel like I understand my own team at the Soleri Report. So you've certainly made a contribution to our communication with each other, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. So anything else you want to add before we...
Yeah, go ahead.
Anything else you want to add before we close?
just congratulations to all the millennials who made this show possible, Catherine, and it's been a pleasure being here.
Thank you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for tonight. Coming up next week, February 28th, is in the last week of the month, we have John Rapoport. This time I'm going to join John. We're going to have a conversation about Ray Kurzweil's theories of singularity, the idea that the artificial intelligence and machines will take over. And we want to talk a little bit about why, you know, why that is so much in the news, why it's important, what you should, what we think about it, and why it's coming. Then March 7th, Eric Hughes on the non-revolution in digital payments. We're going to be talking about Bitcoin, answering a lot of your questions and thoughts about digital currencies. Then March 14th, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about. And then March 21st, how to do a Solari Circle Investment Club. So until next week with John, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one, and you need to start making it multi-generational. So ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.